Coffee House Shots is sponsored by NatWest Group, principal banking partner of the Global Climate Change Summit, COP26, in Glasgow later this year. NatWest is helping its customers reduce their carbon emissions by joining forces with organisations like Microsoft, identifying energy-saving methods for small and medium enterprises. Find out more about their approach to climate change at natwestgroup.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Today, MPs meet in Parliament to talk about the Coronavirus Act in order to renew these emergency powers for the government. Katie, can you tell us about how the debate's been going?
It's a fairly heated debate that's taking place in the Commons right now. Matt Hancock has been fielding questions from MPs in terms of opposition. We know that Labour will be supporting the measures, but it still isn't an easy ride for the Health Secretary. There are plenty of MPs in his own party really uncomfortable with the fact these powers are being extended for a whole 6 months, asking if that's really necessary. Some are saying, such as Steve Bryan, they are going to vote for it, but they're not doing so with a smile. They have many concerns about this. And others, I think Desmond Swain, Charles Walker making very fiery speeches ultimately against the government. And then in terms of opposition outside of the Tory party, you have the Liberal Democrats who are now opposing it. Ed Davey accusing the government of a power grab. I think, I suppose on backbench unrest, now anything too near a result, ultimately don't make too much of a prediction, but we are expecting a Tory rebellion today. Clearly not anything the government has to worry about too much because it will have the numbers. But I do think when pressed, there is an issue in the sense that Matt Hancock would say that he couldn't guarantee this would be the last time these powers would be renewed. There was a chance that in 6 months' time they would be renewed again. And he wasn't suggesting this would happen, but he was just saying, I cannot rule this out. Now, that's in part because there are lots of unpredictable parts to this pandemic, as we've all discovered, in terms of variants and in terms of where it is coming from and so forth. But I do think there is this underlying concern amongst Tory MPs that the process of giving power back is going to not be this, blunt lift all restrictions. Instead, it's the long protracted process, and therefore there is scepticism as to how likely the government is going to give away these things. Now, Matt Hancock said they're only to keep the necessary powers, but you look at some of the things being rolled over today, and I think there is a question about really whether all that is necessary.
I should say to listeners, if you can hear drilling, that's next door's building work still going on. So sorry,
not our stomachs.
Sorry about that, James. We heard about this June 21st date as Freedom Day, essentially, that social distancing might even be going. But now it sounds like if they can't even rule out September renewal of these powers, next winter might be another lockdown winter.
No, so the reason they won't rule out renewing the lockdown powers, and I think Matt Hancock, I think as Katie said, I don't think he answered that question the best way he could have done. The concern is about the so-called the emergence of a vaccine-evading variant, and that you basically could, that's the only circumstance in which you would be back in this situation in the winter. I think the interesting thing here is what the government did with the roadmap was they basically parked most of the difficult questions in review. So foreign travel, big events, social distancing,
vaccine passports,
domestic use. So I think we see all this. But as Katie said, because Labour are backing the government on this, they have the numbers. And I think it is an interesting question that, there is just a lack of scrutiny here, not with amendments, not even being debated and voted on, because Labour are basically prepared to go along with this. And I think it doesn't make for good. I always think this in a general rule, when you see something's passed House of Commons and the number in front, the first number is a 5, it generally is bad legislation because it hasn't been properly scrutinised because there is too much agreement among the main parties on it.
Katie, you mentioned that Ed Davey, his position on this is quite interesting, isn't it? Because Labour is supporting the government, but Ed Davey seems to be taking a slightly different position.
Yes, I mean, the Liberal Democrats are voting against it today. So, in terms of that's a number the government needs to worry about, no, the number of Liberal Democrat MPs is very low. But ultimately, starting to make the Liberal argument that you need fewer draconian powers and actually bringing back responsibility to the individual and calling for a roadmap of return to civil liberties. I think this is interesting because I think particularly because of Brexit, the Liberal Democrat Party feels very far away from where lots of Tories have been. But I think this will appeal to some in the Tory party or Tory supporters in terms of who are returning to that liberal argument, which does feel as though it is missing, despite Boris Johnson talking about all this returning of freedom. And that's what Ed Davey was picking up in the chamber recently, ultimately saying to the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson keeps talking about returning freedom, but where is that? And ultimately, that's what a lot of his Tory MPs think too. It was interesting, Philip Davies. Now, I don't think Philip Davies represents mainstream Conservative Party opinion, but there was an interesting question at PMQs where Philip Davies ultimately described his views, low tax, pro-individual freedoms, and said ultimately, Prime Minister, am I still a Conservative? Mm. Boris Johnson said yes and moved on. But there is an issue that I think that we often hear about unhappy Tory MPs, but it does feel as though it's building up a bit because we've heard about this great success of a vaccination programme. The roadmap, as you were saying, lots of people thought freedom on June 21st, but the really tricky bit, the bit which is going to be actually the most controversial, and why in a way I do think Mark Harper and the COVID recovery group, when they focus so much on moving things forward, they're almost missing the bigger picture. The things that are going to decide ultimately how much freedom people have this summer, perhaps even earlier, are these reviews that are taking place. So the COVID reviews in terms of social distancing, in terms of foreign travel, in terms of immunity IDs, in terms of the workplace. And those kind of were tucked into the roadmap as things that would be looked at later, but they will have huge implications for what life is like, even when we get to that point on June 21st. First of what is seen as Freedom Day. And therefore, I think that you did hear it a bit in the chamber today. Steve Brown was making this point that the reviews are where the main action is. I wonder if figures such as Mark Harper might start to move their attention there, because it's quite clear from all the rebuttals from Boris Johnson and his ministers, they're not going to move faster. I think that's the more live debate.
And James, speaking of this reviews, obviously we mentioned the vaccine passports. Yesterday, the Prime Minister at the liaison committee got himself into a bit of a muddle on pubs, which he's tried to clarify today. Can you tell listeners what happened yesterday and what he's trying to clear up today?
So what happened yesterday was he suggested it would be up to individual landlords to decide whether they wanted to only allow vaccinated people into pubs or not. Now, I think it's not quite right to say it would be up to individual landlords in any basis, because if pubs were to do that without any backing in the regulations or in a legal change, I think they would be vulnerable to a lawsuit. There's a famous case of a West Indian cricketer called Leary Constantine who was staying in a hotel in the Second World War, or booked a hotel in the Second World War, and they refused service to him on the grounds that they had white American servicemen there who didn't want him to stay in the hotel. And the point was, even though the hotel was a private establishment, it wasn't allowed to. There was an expectation that a place like a hotel or a pub offers services to everyone, that you can't discriminate in that way. So they would need some legal backing. What Boris Johnson has said today on a visit to a school is that, you know, he meant either vaccines or testing. So the idea is it would be COVID status rather than vaccination status. So, you know, this deals with the thing that lots of people pointed out yesterday, which is, you know, how is it fair on pregnant women who are medically advised not to get the vaccine to say that you can't go to places unless you've been vaccinated? Now, I think this gets you into the situation. In my understanding of what the thinking in government is if pubs wanted to operate as they did last summer, so, you know, table service and the like, they wouldn't, you know, that would be, they wouldn't need to do any of this COVID safe certification before people came in. If they wanted to operate as they did in pre-COVID era, people ordering at the bar, large groups, people mingling with each other, then the alternative to being COVID secure would be COVID certification of your patrons. But I think it's more about nightclubs than pubs, because the point about a pub is you can, as last summer showed, you can run a pub in a kind of COVID secure way. What you can't, you know, I think there'd be very little market for the COVID secure nightclub where everyone has to stay 2 meters apart from everybody else. And so the idea is that until you have kind of double jabbed the population, you need some point, some kind of halfway house to some kind of bridging policy. And the idea is that this COVID status certification would work like that, that you could be relaxed about there being no social distancing because you know that people are either have tested negative, have antibodies, or have been vaccinated, and so are much much lower risk of passing the virus on.
And Katie, today is also the day that European leaders virtually meet to talk about whether or not to impose an export ban on vaccines coming out of the EU. Do we know what they might conclude?
We had a statement yesterday from the UK and the EU, which were almost, it was a throwback to the days of the Brexit negotiations, because it was, you know, goodwill on both sides. We're going to keep working together. And, you know, conciliatory approach is the right one. But didn't have much firm in there in terms of what's been agreed. And even today, you know, we're hearing various soundings from Brussels about how they don't need to worry about the UK particularly, because we need second doses from there. And I think ultimately there is a sense in government that they will be able to come to some kind of agreement that isn't going to be a full export ban the UK faces on vaccines from the EU, but also the UK is going to have to give something. Potentially, you're looking at this plant, which has been the subject of recent reports. If the product comes to the UK and then is filled and finished here in the Workhardt factory, at that point, the fill and finish, some would have to go back to the EU, some would stay here. We don't know what the numbers are, but that seems as though that could be the landing zone. I think what's interesting, though, and what we'll see from the details of what they announce is ultimately precedent. And where does this go? Because the infection rates, the number of cases, and sadly the number of deaths soon in the EU are going to be very worrying. And therefore, once you've got to a situation of, in a way, having taken drastic measures or thrown your weight around as a bigger block to get a result back, it sets a precedent of what you might do if the situation gets worse there. So I think there is still some unease in government about the UK rollout in relation to this.
I mean, one of the things that's striking about this summit is it's quite clear that the Commission, like several of the member states, especially the smaller member states that are particularly good at and keen on attracting foreign investment, so don't, from outside the EU, and so don't like the idea of the precedent that this would set, are clearly reluctant. You know, you've had Jean-Claude Juncker, the former Commission president, saying, you know, look, step back from this. This is very bad for the EU's reputation. But it's quite clear that Ursula von der Leyen is digging in. She's trying to push, as Katie said about this point about second doses, you know, don't worry, they can't retaliate, essentially. And I think what you see here is an interesting dynamic about the ways in which the EU is different about the UK. So what you have here is the Commission need to make this work, because they said, look, we want to do the procurement, not the member states. So obviously it's a massive reputational blow to them if they can't get this right. You've got an election in Germany this autumn with the governing party, the CDU, currently falling in the polls. You've got elections in France next year, and Emmanuel Macron very keen to show that kind of Brexit has not been a success in advance of that. And as Katie said, the situation in France with the pandemic is very worrying. So, yeah, particular desire to kind of get hold of vaccines there. And what you are seeing, I think, is normally you look at the countries that are worried about this. Micheál Martin, the Irish Taoiseach, pointed out, you know, the EU aren't producing vaccines. These are companies based in the European Union producing the vaccines. And, you know, worried about the reputational damage. There's Sweden, wasn't meant to be worried. Belgium. But, you know, normally, the Dutch, the obvious large free trading ally for these countries would be the UK in trying to assemble a kind of cautious blocking position on this. With the UK not there, it's much harder for them to resist when the Commission and France and Germany are basically, now there are subtle differences between the positions, but, you know, are basically in agreement on the need to take this very tough line, with, you know, the Commission and Macron slightly further ahead of where Merkel is. And so I think we are seeing a thing about the nature, the ways in which the EU has been changed by Brexit and the absence of the British presence in these discussions.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And for more discussion on the EU and the UK's vaccine wars, I'd recommend Coffee House Shots listeners to go to today's Spectator TV episode. It's going to be live at 6 o'clock if you go to spectator.co.uk/TV. Andrew Neil interviews staunch Europhile and former People's Vote campaigner Andrew Adonis about this. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.